This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Walmart is the world's largest private employer, with nearly 2 million employees worldwide and 1.4 million in the United States. It just reported second quarter earnings of $3.44 billion, slightly ahead of projections. To its critics, Walmart is emblematic of what's wrong with corporate America. It's made a science of cutting costs by building massive distribution centers, squeezing suppliers, and pinching the wages and benefits of its employees. Walmart executives have long argued that the result of its efforts is lower prices for everybody, effectively giving us all a raise. And as the company has come under attack from unions and other activists in recent years, it's focused more on environmental protection and sustainability in its operations, purchasing, and corporate giving. Our guest, Nelson Lichtenstein, has written a history of Walmart, beginning with its founding by the late Sam Walton and tracing its phenomenal growth, which Lichtenstein says was linked to the cultural and religious values of Bible Belt America. He says Walmart has transformed retailing but created a business model that is ultimately unsustainable. Nelson Lichtenstein is a history professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His book is called The Retail Revolution: How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. Nelson Lichtenstein, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us about Walmart's headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas. That's in a fairly rural part of the state, right?
Yes, it's in extreme northwest Arkansas. It's a kind of bustling, booming, now middle-sized town with all sorts of new construction going on. And there are some 750 of these vendors who've established sort of offices there, including Procter & Gamble in nearby Fayetteville, which is the university town. And then I was struck, for example, Walt Disney, which, you know, sells lots of cuddly, you know, little dolls and things. You'd assume that Walt Disney would have its retail headquarters in Los Angeles. But no, it's right there next to Walmart in northwest Arkansas.
And of course, Walmart has enormous power with respect to its vendors, those who supply all the goods on its shelves. And I guess this grew out of the patriarch of the firm, Sam Walton, who, and in the book you give a fascinating description of how he made his career in retail. How did he change the relationship between his retail stores and these manufacturers who made the goods?
Well, right. Well, Sam Walton was there in northwest Arkansas where he had his first set of stores, and he was always irritated and vexed by the fact that getting the goods to his stores was a difficult, complicated thing. There were intermediaries, there were jobbers, there were suppliers. They didn't really want to go to northwest Arkansas. It was kind of out of the way, and therefore, it was expensive to get, you know, goods to his stores. He wanted to have a discount operation. He wanted to sell stuff cheap. So he said, well, I'll establish my own distribution centers, my own warehouses, and thereby, cut out the middleman. And he really couldn't stand salesmen. But his key thing was first setting up his own distribution centers in Arkansas and then in the states around there. And he owned them. The firm owned them. This was a big innovation that Walmart made, really the same magnitude as the first assembly line that Henry Ford created in the early 20th century to eliminate as many of these middlemen as possible. And the fact that all the vendors end up in Bentonville, with offices, is a kind of visible indication that he's gotten rid of a lot of those middlemen.
So instead of buying products from some marketed guy who dealt with the manufacturer, he ended up buying a big fleet of trucks and building these huge warehouses and buying direct from manufacturers and just having all that stuff right there to deliver to his stores when they needed them.
Yeah, that's correct. And here's a word we should consider, the word warehouse. They aren't warehouses, they're distribution centers, and here's the difference. There had been warehouses. Warehouses were places you stored stuff, got off the ship from Europe, stored it for several months, or, got off the train from, and you stuck it in a place, when you needed it, you took it out of there. Walton, that's a waste of money. That's a waste of time. That's a waste of space. Walton built distribution centers so that The truck came in one end of the distribution center, and 12 hours later, the stuff left the other side of the distribution center, repackaged, and going to every individual store. And so if you go to one of the 120 giant distribution centers that Walmart has right now, the goods never stand still. What they're composed of are hundreds of miles of conveyor belts, which take the goods from trucks coming from the supplier, from the factory, and then moving it around and resorting it and then going off to the stores.
To move all the stuff efficiently, you'd need a really sophisticated information system which balances the needs of the stores and what the manufacturers can to deliver. And you point out that Walton was among the first to use the barcodes to develop that kind of information, and that was critical in transforming his relationship with these suppliers. How did it work?
Yes. The barcode was actually invented, came out of the grocery industry in the very early 70s, 60s and 70s. They thought that they would eliminate a lot of clerks and checkout people and speed it up by having, everyone knows what these barcodes are, this electronic system of registering the price. And it did do that to some extent, although it turned out it wasn't quite as much labor-saving as they thought. But they didn't understand, the grocery people didn't understand, but Walton did, that the real advantage of the barcode was the question of the information it contained about where and when sales were made and how much the cost of the item was. And so Walton began to install these barcode scanners in his discount stores, which were selling not necessarily groceries, but selling other things. That was considered a great innovation. And then he captured the information about, how many tubes of toothpaste were sold in the morning versus the afternoon versus at this price or that price. For years, for decades, it had been the manufacturer, Procter & Gamble, Colgate, etc., which jealously guarded that kind of information. And then they took surveys. Procter & Gamble invented the soap opera as a way of, selling this stuff. They were the ones who would go to the merchant and say, look, here's, we know exactly how much you're going to sell. We want you to take these five boxes of toothpaste because we've made the surveys. Well, Walton upended that relationship entirely after he put all the barcode scanners in and built a gigantic data warehouse in Bentonville. It looks like something out of the Pentagon. There are no windows. It's a huge building. There are guards all around it. Anyway, this was a mechanism for him to gain the knowledge, to assemble it, to slice it, to dice it. And as we know, knowledge is power.
Give us an example of how the leverage that all this information gave Walmart allowed them to dictate to suppliers.
Well, for example, with Procter & Gamble is a good example. It's a huge company. It has a office in near Bentonville with 250 people in it. It sells billions and billions to Walmart each year. But when it comes to the sales of its various products, Tide or the toothpaste or soap, Walton and Walmart today can tell Procter & Gamble precisely the kind of products that sell better in Florida versus Minnesota versus some other place, and can literally direct the factories that Procter & Gamble has, either in the U.S. or abroad, where to send this material. And they don't have to it's such a big supplier, it doesn't even go through the warehouses anymore. It goes directly from the factories directly to the various stores because they put that entirely computerized. In fact, they don't even order material from Procter & Gamble anymore. The computers are interlaced, are interconnected, so that when a sale takes place, in California for a tube of toothpaste, the electronic impulse goes directly to Procter & Gamble, and then they produce more toothpaste. So it's a much more efficient system, and of course they've wrung out a lot of the overhead, and Procter & Gamble's making money, and Walmart is definitely making money.
Tell us about the internal culture of Walmart.
Well, Walmart was founded in the rural South in the 1950s and 60s. It was one of the last places in the country that the agricultural revolution really hit. That is the depopulation of the rural areas, the elimination of the family farm. The Ozarks were an area of small farming and subsistence farming, really. So you had a terrific surplus population of ex-farmers. Some of them went to California and the North and Chicago, but many of them wanted to stay in the Ozarks. And they also wanted to stay in a kind of small town environment in which they, you know, their friends and neighbors were right there. So the rise of the discount stores that Walton was now creating in this area sort of took the place of the farmstead. And often you would have people who'd lost their farm would now move into the role of a manager. This would be for the men, the manager of the store. And then the clerks were the women who had been, you know, the helpers on the farm, you know. And so you sort of replicated that rural, patriarchal kind of culture in the store. Sam Walton, I mean, I don't know how self-conscious he was about that, but clearly he embodied that himself. He was proud and advertised the fact that he was sort of a good old boy, although he'd gone to college, but he loved to hunt and shoot, and he had a very stable marriage, and his kids went into the business, and he was, you know, sort of the paterfamilias. He was Mr. Sam, there was a genuine loyalty to him and veneration of Sam Walton in the early years of the firm.
And so there was a sense of family, right? I mean, you don't call your workers employees; you call them associates, right?
That's right, associates. I mean, this was the associates. They created a whole variety of names, of different names, for traditional things, in industrial relations. They weren't workers; they were associates. The managers were not managers; they were coaches. Meetings they had, their annual stockholder meeting was not a state affair with people with suits. There was country music and canoe trips and barbecues and all sorts of stuff like that. So they tried successfully to create this sense of family. And there was a kind of, in the early years, and it's changed since then, of course, in the early years, a sense of identification between the Sam Walton, living in Northwest Arkansas himself, and the many, many associates that he hired, many of whom came right off the farm.
Our guest is Nelson Lichtenstein. His book is called The Retail Revolution: How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Nelson Lichtenstein. He's written a new book about Walmart called The Retail Revolution. So what are some of the ways that Walmart today holds down its labor costs?
Well, one is no overtime, certainly for those who aren't hourly. But at the same time, when it comes to people who are on salary, assistant managers who make maybe $45,000 a year, there they work 50, 60, 70 hours a week regularly. Furthermore, Walmart is a company which has sort of abolished the weekend or done a lot. They have Saturday morning meetings for many executives and lower level folk in and around Bentonville and also out in the field to some extent. And so the weekend, which we thought was completely established, has now been sort of shaved back. And so Saturday morning for many Walmart workers is a regular day of work. That really returns us to the situation in the 1920s. Because of the bonus that these managers receive, based in part on keeping labor costs low, for many years, and to some extent still today, they were under great pressure to shave those costs. And sometimes that meant doing illegal things in the stores, like literally going into the computer program and cutting out hours that people had actually worked.
And they tend to keep they use a lot of part-timers, right? They run stores, a lot of these stores, around the clock, so people are on odd schedules and often don't get the 34 hours a week that make them full-time, right?
Well, that's right. When Walmart, especially after it went to selling groceries, which meant that it went 24/7, hired a lot of part-timers. About a third of the workforce is part-time, but full-time is defined as 34 hours a week, so that's less than a 40-hour week. What that means is that everyone who works at Walmart is desperate to get more hours. And that gives terrific sort of power to the manager, who can then play one worker off against the other, or give rewards, or penalties by cutting back hours.
Walmart prides itself on offering health insurance to its employees. What kind of health insurance does it offer?
Well, it solves this problem in two ways. Health insurance is very expensive, and it's been very assiduous in trying to keep this cost down. One is they hire a lot of people who get their health insurance from somewhere else. Older people, young people, people whose spouse works somewhere else. So Walmart claims that 90% of all its workers have health insurance, and they do, but only about 51% now have their health insurance from Walmart itself. Now, with the Walmart insurance, they've really adopted the Republican conservative solution to the healthcare crisis in America. And it's this: you offer health insurance policies with very low premiums and very high deductibles, as much as $3,000 or more. And then you give a health security account to each individual, which they can put money in themselves, or the company can put some money in, which they can use for regular office visits. Now, the problem with this system is that when you have any serious illness, you have to pay out of pocket up to $3,000 plus your premiums plus copays before the insurance kicks in. And for, say, a mother, a single mother with two kids earning $22,000 a year at Walmart, it means that 25% or even 30% of their income can easily go to health insurance if their kids just have ear infections and the normal kind of things that lots of kids get, which is one reason that lots of Walmart employees don't even sign up for the Walmart health insurance.
You know, Walmart obviously is aware that its labor policies have created an image issue, and it's made an effort in recent years to reach out to some liberal constituencies. I mean, it's promoted the Al Gore film An Inconvenient Truth. It's undertaken some important sustainability efforts in its own buildings and practices, and I think even made some efforts to kind of get organic foods on its shelves. Some have been impressed by these. How do you regard these initiatives?
Well, many of these efforts in the environmental field, sustainability, they're kind of a win-win. Walmart does want to run its trucks with using less fuel. That saves money, and it's good for the environment. And in the entire supply chain, that's the phrase they use for how to get the supplier's goods to the store. There's many, many places where you can save money, and you can also do good things for the environment. So I think there's a lot of genuine activity here that's good for everyone. If it's good for Walmart's public relations, that's fine as well. I think the big box itself is a problem. A lot of people find that a kind of environmental and urban planning a problem. Walmart has not been as successful at putting smaller stores in urban areas, for example. Another side of this, though, which I think is more significant, is that Walmart was very aware that it was subject to many, many lawsuits, lots of bad public relations for its not just its low wages, but its illegal payment of low wages, its failure to adhere to the standard variety law governing wages, hours, etc. And so after the election of Barack Obama in November, Walmart clearly made a decision that they wanted to solve that problem. So on December 23rd, while everyone else was thinking about Christmas, Walmart announced that it would settle 63 wage and hour class action lawsuits against it at a price of upwards of $600 million. Now, Walmart had a terrific reputation, a fearsome reputation for never settling class action lawsuits. I mean, they just said, these are just people trying to come after us and get some of our money. But they agreed to settle them. It's because Obama was elected. Hilda Solis was the new Secretary of Labor, who would a little later say, there's a new sheriff in town, we're going to enforce these laws. And I think this is as significant as the environmental activities. And if Walmart does continue to settle these kind of suits and agree to obey the law, that will be significant.
Nelson Lichtenstein will be back in the second half of the show. He's a history professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book is The Retail Revolution: How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with Nelson Lichtenstein, who's written a history of Walmart, which is the world's largest private employer. Lichtenstein says Walmart founder Sam Walton made an obsession of cutting costs by building massive distribution centers, squeezing suppliers, and scrimping on employees' wages and benefits. Lichtenstein says Walmart has created a business model others have tried to replicate, but he says it's a model that's ultimately unsustainable. His book is called The Retail Revolution: How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. You know, in the debate in the past about the Walmart business model, the company has admitted at times that its wages are lower than some, that some of its employees aren't raising families on them. But they also have another argument, which is that their low prices and the pressure that they exert on their competitors to lower prices amount, in effect, to raising everybody's standard of living, giving everybody else a raise. What about that argument?
Well, there's truth to it as far as it goes. That is, there has been a reduction in the price of groceries, of clothing, the kind of things that you buy at a Walmart store. And the company's estimated it, you know, is up to as much as $2,000 a year would be saved by a typical family buying at Walmart. And that's true. And I celebrate that. I think that's terrific. It's good to have stuff that's inexpensive. The problem is this. The kind of things you buy at Walmart only represent about 20% of the typical family budget, and it's actually been declining in recent years. The things you can't buy at Walmart, which really are eating up and are pressuring families, health care, housing, transportation, education, you can't buy those at Walmart yet. You can buy them with higher wages. So to the extent that Walmart lowers the wage level for its own employees and everyone else, it's making it much more difficult for people to buy the 80% of the things they need to sustain the family budget, which you can't buy at Walmart. And that's the problem.
You know, there are a lot of retailers that have seen Walmart's success and are copying some of its methods, Target and others. And you say at the end of this book, Walmart and its clones face a day of reckoning. Their relentless growth and Darwinian competitiveness have created a world that is increasingly inhospitable to their own success. What do you mean?
Well, by that I mean to the extent that wages remain stagnant and there's a political backlash against the benefit levels, it means that the day of reckoning is coming, that they can't continue with that model. And I think that was shown both with the recent recession. Although Walmart did pretty well, lots and lots of retailers went bankrupt in that recession. And it's also true politically. Walmart has been stymied in its effort to expand throughout the rest of the United States. In fact, it cut the number of stores that it would open by one-third 2 years ago. So it faces that sort of political and even cultural resistance. And I think it's trying now to get out from under that burden. And we'll see whether that takes place. But I think there is a kind of recognition in the firm that the model set up by Sam Walton 40 years ago can't continue today.
Give us a sense of what it was like to deal with Walmart as a researcher and writer. I mean, would their executives talk to you? Did you get access to information you needed?
Well, I did talk to some of them, but I could read what they said on their very elaborate webpage, and then I could, you know, they would much rather talk to the New York Times than to some obscure historian, at least as far as they were concerned, on the West Coast. However, I found it far better and more rewarding not to talk to current Walmart managers, but to talk to retired Walmart managers and workers, of which there are a lot, because there's a kind of burnout at the firm, and lots of people retire in their 50s if they can. Also, there have been all these lawsuits against Walmart. Well, these lawyers became kind of my research assistants. That is, they would be deposing Walmart executives. They would be ferreting out various documents and things. And much of this became in the part of the public record, so I was able to use that. Furthermore, there was an amazing archive of videos that turned up in Kansas. There had been a firm in Kansas, Flagler Productions, for 25 years had been doing videos of all of Walmart's meetings, many of them not open to the public, and they had a huge archive there. Well, then Walmart fired the firm about 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, the firm thinking, well, we got to make money. We got to, you know, let's open this to the public. And so I went down there and I saw many of these videos and the transcripts. And that was terrific.
Can you share a moment from one of those videos that you found particularly revealing?
Yes. Well, one of the most remarkable was a fellow by the name of John Tate. John Tate was Sam Walton's age, same generation, and Sam Walton hired him in the early 70s to handle the company's labor relations. John Tate had got his start in North Carolina. He'd been a right-wing activist in Nebraska. He was a lawyer, and he pioneered many, many of the techniques that today are standard in stopping unions. Some legal, many legal, but some a little not legal. The kind of demonization of unionism which takes place in the retail industry. Well, Tate, this amazing speech he gave in the year 2004, kind of a valedictory, in which he told, you know, 500 cheering Walmart managers that, you know, I've been fighting unions all my life. Unions are blood-sucking institutions. Your job is to go out there and, you know, help me complete my life's work. This was genuine. It was emotional. He got a cheer, and it completely contradicted the official Walmart line.
Do you shop at Walmart?
Yes, when I can. I have no objection to shopping at a big firm like that. I buy cars produced on assembly lines, and I buy products sold at the most efficient form of retailing. And I'd like to change the company, but I see no problem with shopping there.
Well, Nelson Lichtenstein, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Delighted to do so.
Nelson Lichtenstein's book is called The Retail Revolution: How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. Coming up, Dr. Lisa Sanders explains why doctors are misdiagnosing illnesses more than you think. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Lisa Sanders is fascinated with medical mysteries. A practicing internist on the faculty of the Yale Medical School, she writes the diagnosis column for the New York Times Magazine, in which she describes and analyzes unusual cases. And she's a technical advisor for the Fox TV series House, in which a condescending, pill-popping doctor solves a tough medical puzzle every week. But Sanders' new book is more than just a collection of fascinating yarns from the examining room. She argues that despite remarkable advances in medical technology, doctors are misdiagnosing their patients' ailments at a surprising rate, between 10% and 15% of the time, according to studies. She offers some interesting reasons for why physicians sometimes miss the boat and some ideas for sharpening their skills. Her book is called Every Patient Tells a Story: Medical Mysteries and the Art of Diagnosis. Well, Lisa Sanders, welcome to Fresh Air. You make the point in the book that it's really important to take a thorough history from the patient, find out, you know, why they're there and what their medical and history has been, what they've experienced. Do doctors listen as well as they should?
I think we all know the answer to that.
Right.
No, we don't. And shame on us, because it's been known for a really long time that the patient is the source of the information that most of the time, sometimes up to 90% of the time, will give us the answer to the question, what's going on? What does this patient have? But we don't listen to patients, and it's hard to listen to patients. As a news interviewer or as an interviewer, you know that when you talk to somebody, you have two conversations that are going on. You have the conversation that you're having with the person you're talking to, and you have the other conversation, am I getting what I need? What a doctor does is very similar. They're having a conversation, just a regular conversation. Tell me what's going on. When did you start feeling bad? But they're also having this other conversation inside their heads of, Am I getting what I need? Is this enough information? What does this all mean? And so I think that we're not trained to do that. You just have to pick it up. You have to learn it on the fly. And some doctors are better at it than others. But it hasn't really been valued in the way we train doctors. And so if we don't listen, maybe it's because we didn't really teach doctors how to listen.
Wasn't there a study which actually recorded interviews by physicians and gave us a sense of what the interaction was like?
Absolutely. There's actually been two that were a few years apart. And they showed the same thing, which is basically doctors let patients talk for an average of 20 seconds before they interrupt, sometimes even less. In the most recent study, some doctors let a patient talk for only 3 seconds before they interrupted. And they interrupted with a very specific question usually. But the chance that the patient would go back and finish that story is almost zero. I mean, it almost never happens. They get distracted. New information prompts new questions, and people go on to, you know, describe other symptoms. But having the patient tell the story is thought to be the most efficient way of getting all this data out, and yet we don't do it.
And do the studies also indicate that when doctors do interrupt, that they get an inaccurate picture of what's going on with the patient?
They can. Sometimes you can be right, and you take it in the direction where it absolutely needs to go. But that's not always the case. And up to 50% of the time, when a patient leaves the doctor's office and they've been asked about it, they have symptoms that they didn't get to talk about. Half the time, a doctor and a patient will not agree on what the purpose of the visit was about.
That's after the visit?
After the visit. If they're questioned separately, what the doctor thinks that the appointment was about and what the patient thought that the appointment was about are going to be two different things half the time. So that's crazy. And that's a bad way of collecting the most important data that we have. I mean, I think that there was a sense that we all know how to ask questions, we all know how to hear the answers, that this was not something that needed to be taught. But I think that studies like these suggest that we're wrong on that. And actually, one of the other difficult things about it is there's a certain anxiety when you're confronted with something that somebody who's sick or facts that you're not able to add up. And that uncertainty, that provokes a certain anxiety that makes you want to find an answer.
You mean the doctor, the physician may be uncomfortable with sort of the emotional atmosphere of the encounter?
I think the doctor himself will have emotions about seeing a patient where you don't know what's going on and those feelings. I mean, none of us are wildly comfortable with uncertainty, I think. You have to be a very special kind of person to be comfortable in the face of real uncertainty. So when a doctor is faced with this kind of uncertainty, the first thought that passes his mind is often grabbed on with both hands. The right thing to do, of course, and what I teach my residents and medical students is to make note of what you're thinking, but listen, and wait. Because the average patient's story lasts less than 2 minutes. So you only have to wait 2 minutes before you ask your question. And yet, sometimes it can be very hard.
You write in the book that the physical exam, once our most reliable tool in understanding and diagnosing a sick patient, is dead. What do you mean?
I think it's gone. We're all taught the physical exam in medical school, but it doesn't take long for you to realize as a student, as a resident, as a young doctor, that no one cares what you find on physical exam. That it's really what the tests show, it's what the tests show. And yet it's clear that the physical exam has important things to tell us. It can direct where we look. It can tell us, show us in a very real way what's going on.
Can you think of an example of a case where reliance upon tests and technology and neglect of a physical exam led to a misdiagnosis?
Oh, many. There was one case, a young woman. She was a resident, a doctor in training. She came. She was brought to the emergency room by her fiancé. Her heart was beating quickly, too fast to be normal. Her eyes were incredibly sensitive to the light, and she was speaking incoherently. She was delirious. When she opened her mouth, a flood of words came out, but they didn't make any sense. She was taken to the emergency room, put in a nice, quiet room. When the doctor came in and turned on the light, she called out because the light hurt her eyes. And so he shut down the lights so that it was very low and she was comfortable. You know, he was her friend. He didn't want her to be uncomfortable. He was worried about her. And so because of that, he didn't notice a couple of really important things. He didn't notice that her skin, which was normally fair, light-colored, was bright red. He didn't notice that her mouth was very dry. He didn't notice that her eyes were incredibly dilated. All these things would have been important clues to what was wrong with her. She had been poisoned by a plant in her yard that she had thought was lettuce, and so had eaten. This set of symptoms is so common. We have a mnemonic for it. You know, when somebody is mad as a hatter, red as a beet, hot as a hare, blind as a bat. So these are all clues that we're all taught about this kind of poisoning. But because he didn't want to make her uncomfortable and didn't really value what he could see by doing this exam, he didn't turn on the light. And yet, if she had said, "I'd really rather not have a CAT scan," oh, that would never stand. Everybody would be in there trying to talk her into it. But without a peep, he lowered the lights, cutting himself off from the data that could have led him to a diagnosis.
Our guest is Dr. Lisa Sanders. Her new book is Every Patient Tells a Story. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Lisa Sanders. She has a new book about errors in diagnosis called Every Patient Tells a Story. I was interested in a case that you describe in the book, a woman you call Carlotta, your own patient, I believe, as a first-year resident who had a lot of difficulty and a lot of pain, and you were struggling despite tests to figure out what was going on. And a third-year resident listened to them and noted that she seemed to be having pain out of proportion to the physical exam. And she said, now that, when I put it together with the other things, are the classic symptoms of ischemic colitis, which is an infection of the colon caused by a shortage of blood supply. And the point you made was that that wasn't a collection of symptoms and diagnosis that you would have found in any book. She just knew that that excessive pain combined with the other things tended to be classic symptoms of ischemic colitis. Do you find that there is this oral tradition in which doctors share things with one another that maybe aren't there in books?
This is one of the ancient parts of medicine, that it really does have to be learned at the bedside from the patient with the guidance of somebody older, more experienced, wiser. We all hope to get to be that older, more experienced, and wiser doctor, but this is the route to getting there, is to being at the bedside with the patient and somebody smarter than you. It's how medicine is learned and has been always, even when there was not that much to know. It's always been the way medicine is done. There's all these aphorisms that are one of the teaching tools in medicine, ways to remember all the millions of pieces of data. My favorite aphorism, when I was taking care of a guy who was found down in the snow on the side of the road. So he had hypothermia, very, very low body temperature. The emergency room doctor, he had no pulse. Nobody could hear a heartbeat. EKG couldn't pick up anything. But the ER doctor said, "You're never dead until you're warm and dead." And so they slowly warmed him up. As his body warmed up, we started to feel a quiet pulse. And then his respiration became obvious, and then we could pick up his heartbeat, and he was fine. He walked out of the hospital. But I'll never forget that. You're never dead until you're warm and dead. This is the way medicine is passed on. It's part of this old tradition that has been part of medicine from the beginning. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, wrote three volumes that he called aphorisms, and they're just these one-liners about with an associated story about things to observe and things to know in medicine.
For years, you've written this column for the New York Times Magazine about diagnosis in which fascinating medical mysteries are explored. And you're a technical advisor for House, the very successful Fox TV series about the acerbic pill-popping doctor who's so brilliant at cracking a medical mystery every week. So what's your role? Do you provide obscure illnesses and mysterious diagnoses to the show, and then they build a series, an episode around them?
Yeah, I mean, usually the writers have an idea of what kinds of things they want to have happen, and they'll call me up and say, so do you know of any diseases that can do this, that, and the other thing? Okay, and what are some of the complications of that disease? And what are some of the complications of treating what we thought it might have been but isn't? And what are some of the complications? What are some of the problems you can run into if you're doing this strange test for this other disease? So they call me up, and I'm a resource, and it's great. I love coming up with weird diseases. When I read the literature, the medical literature, I'm always on the outlook for some odd thing to pass on to House. And then in the hospitals that I work in, people come to me with odd things and I pass them on. Last season or the season before last, House was doing surgery on a patient and cut him open, and his bowel gas caught on fire, and there was a huge fire in the operating room. It was fantastic. But that was based on something that happened in the hospital where I'm an attending physician. So I passed, as soon as I heard it, I knew it was House material. In fact, I heard it because the resident it happened to ran to tell me as soon as her hand healed.
Now, you're telling me that in your hospital someone's bowel gas caught on fire?
Uh-huh. It happens, you know. I'm sure there are only two cases written of this in the medical literature. I'm sure it happens a lot more frequently than that, but it's I guess people don't really want to talk about it that much, but it's fantastic. And it totally makes sense once you understand the physics of it.
Well, at the risk of being crude, how does it get ignited?
When you make a cut, you sew up large vessels that bleed, but little tiny vessels that bleed are usually cauterized. And we use basically an arc welder on a very tiny scale. So it puts out a little spark, and that cauterizes the little vessel. So you take methane and a little spark and a tiny hole, and you have high pressure gas going by a flame, and you have an explosion. So, the resident who was operating said that the flame shot up 10 or 12 feet and said that the lights at the top of the ceiling were, covered in smoke and melted. The covers were melted. So wow. It was let me just say, the patient did fine. The attending surgeon took the scalpel out of the surgeon's hand and opened the incision wider so that the gas just diffused out quietly, and that put out the fire. And the patient, they went ahead and did what they needed to do for the patient and sewed him up, told him about it, and he was completely fine.
You know, as you've looked at the art of diagnosis, I mean, you've made the point that some studies suggest as much as 15% of diagnoses are inaccurate, and that there are a number of ways in which kind of the training and structure of medicine don't give physicians the kind of habits that they really should have to do careful physical exams and listen to patient histories and think, in an open-minded way about problems. And the nation's now beginning to think about how it's going to restructure at least how it pays for medical care and to some extent how medical care may be structured. Do you have an opinion about how health care reform should proceed?
Absolutely. And I think that it would be hard to find doctors, especially internists, who don't have very strong opinions on this. We don't have the time that we need. We don't have the tools that we need because what we do is not valued. Thinking, which is really what a doctor does, thinking, examining, questioning, is not valued by the system. It wasn't designed that way. It was just an accident. But doing is what really counts. Thinking, not so much. For example, not long ago, I had, I guess, 9 or 10 patients in a half day. My first 9 patients were the usual diabetes, high blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, cold, cough, bronchitis. The last patient I'd scheduled at the end of the day needed his ingrown toenail removed. So I see everybody. Every patient gets 20 minutes for the most part. This last patient also gets 20 minutes. I cut out his toenail and give him a Band-Aid and send him on his way. But for that procedure, I got paid more than I did for all the patients I had seen prior to him, because we value doing rather than thinking. So I would certainly encourage reform to allow for people to think, because it's thinking fundamentally that's going to save us money.
Well, Lisa Sanders, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Dr. Lisa Sanders' new book is called Every Patient Tells a Story, Medical Mysteries and the Art of Diagnosis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Les Paul, the guitarist and inventor who made 36 gold records and developed new instrumental and recording techniques, died today. He was 94. In the 50s, he recorded many hits with his wife, Mary. We'll close with one of them. This is How High the Moon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.